This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
At the end of this year, we'd like to wish everyone a very, very happy holiday and all the best for 2019. Everyone be safe and happy during this holiday season. Here's to you. See you here.
Episode 59 of See Here Podcast. Morris is my name. I don't have my compadres with me. Tim isn't here because when we actually recorded most of this episode, we finished at about 3 in the morning and I was very keen to get to bed. Haven't had a chance to arrange to record this intro together. And Bernie's not around because he's lying in bed sick with a cold and he said he sounds like Barry White. Now, I don't know why he thinks that's a bad thing. I reckon it would have been quite cool to have him on the podcast sounding like Barry White. I don't know, maybe he's more of an Isaac Hayes fan. Anyway, I'll do this intro nice and quick for you. What you're about to hear is an interview that Tim and I had the other night with the wonderful director Alan Arkush, director of such wonderful music films like Rock and Roll High School, Get Crazy, and The Temptations, amongst many other non-music related things. Now, we speak a little bit about his own films because he's a director and we want to speak about his films, but we focused a lot on his time as an usher at the Fillmore East because that was obviously something he was very, very passionate about. We speak a bit about Joe Dante's project, The Trailers from Hell, and we also do get to speak about some of his own films and we speak about some other rock and roll films that he loves. We are a music film podcast, so the focus very much is on rock and roll films in this interview. So we really hope that you enjoy this. It's now 5 years since we started the See Here podcast to talk about music-related films, and a fifth birthday present that would be better, I cannot imagine. So sit back, enjoy yourself, and I'll come back at the end of the interview to talk with you about what we're going to be having in January of 2019. We'll be back shortly. You're listening to See Here. To episode 59 of See Here Podcast, and Tim and I are absolutely schwitzing. We are so excited because on the other end of a Skype connection, we have in New York, not in Los Angeles, he's on a trip to New York, the wonderful director Alan Arkush. Welcome to See Here Podcast, Alan.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here. We're worldwide on this particular episode.
We are.
Oh, yeah.
We are. Actually, I'm feeling like I missed an opportunity there. I should have introduced you as a longer Loksh.
Oh, you saw my video memoirs.
Yes, yes. We'll maybe get into that in a little bit. But
sure.
Why we've gone and asked you onto the podcast is because we've been listening to your appearance on Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal podcast, plus the videos that you've been putting on the Trailers from Hell website, and you're a huge fan of the history of music-related films. And we'll obviously be getting into some of your own music-related films. But I wanted to start off that you'd gone and said that Hard Day's Night was a film that made you want to become a filmmaker. And it sort of seems unusual because we hear so many stories from musicians who say, I saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, or whatever part of the world they were in, they saw the Beatles and they said, that made me want to pick up a guitar, or made me want to get a set of Ludwig drums or something like that. But you went a little bit different. You said, I want to become a filmmaker. So what was it about A Hard Day's Night that appealed to you from a storytelling perspective as opposed to becoming a musician?
Well, I made that analogy quite on purpose because having been in 10th grade, 16 years old, the night that the Beatles played Ed Sullivan, because the next day everyone wanted to be in a band. I was aware of that. When I started doing my video memoirs and looked back at it, I realized in that context what it felt like. Mm. Now, I had loved the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, and I was quite excited. And I had their records, and by then I probably had heard the Rolling Stones, and I was listening to Dylan, and I had gone to the Lee Theater to see Hard Day's Night at the Lee Theater on opening night. I was playing my records a lot and driving my parents a little crazy playing the same records over and over again, loudly. And I was so taken by Hard Day's Night. And my father and mother were very interested in the visual arts and in movies. And they also went to see a lot of foreign movies.
Right.
And I saw a foreign movie starting from when I was about 14 years old. So at that point, for 2 years, I was aware of foreign movies. I was certainly aware of classic movies. And they had recommended movies to me. And I'd gone to the Lee Theater and seen them. And we had already seen Lawrence of Arabia, which I just was floored by. It was my idea of a great, great movie. And at that time, the two great movies that most people were aware of my age was like West Side Story and Lawrence of Arabia. Those movies were about places and things that were exotic. They were all larger than life. Even a movie that I loved at that point, like Bravo or The Horse Soldiers, they're all larger than life. They are something that you don't know anything about that comes to you in that movie, mm-hmm. as well as all the Disney movies that we were growing up with. But I walked into that theater already liking the Beatles and have seen them on television and had an impression of them. So when the movie starts and they're running, is it George that trips and falls? But
right, yeah, I think it is, yeah.
They're coming towards you. It was so thrilling. And then within 5 minutes, you were aware that this universe had been created by Richard Lester. And the universe and the energy of it and the style of it was as new as the Beatles and reflective of it, as well as emphasizing the us versus them aspects of the world at that point, because this is just really when the generation gap is kicking in between the baby boomers and their parents. Mm-hmm. And there's like a scene in the movie where they want to open the windows and this guy says, you can't. And he says, we won the war for you. And, you know, all that stuff.
Look, mister, we pay for our seats too, you know. I travel on this train regularly, twice a week.
Knock it off, Paul. You can't win with his sword. After all, it's his train, isn't it, mister?
And don't take that tone with me, young man. I fought the war for your sword.
I bet you saw you won.
And it was very clearly two generations. So I was so sympathetic to it and so involved in it and so swept up in it. And the scene, they're looking for Paul's father and they find him and they put him in a cage in the baggage car. And they're playing cards and they're talking. And all of a sudden, John's got a harmonica and they start singing, I Should Have Known Better With a Girl Like You. And it's just so thrilling. And the song coming out of life, you know what I mean? It isn't like they're standing on a stage. They just start singing it, okay? All of a sudden, these girls appear and their instruments appear, and it's so infectious, and the train is bouncing back and forth, and at a certain point, the camera starts dancing along with the Beatles, up and down, back and forth. And it was a breaking of the fourth wall, which now I know what it is. But then it was, nothing can resist the Beatles. And as the movie went on, the energy of the movie so matched the music, it illustrated the music. And I was so taken with it that at the end of the movie, when the helicopter flies away and they're in it, and the screen starts black, and then as they raise up, and it's like the Beatles ascending into heaven, and the leaflets being thrown, the pictures being thrown out. I was just floored by this. I went home, walked home, very excited. And my parents said to me something like, how is your Beatle movie? You know, kind of a little condescending. And I stopped and thought about it because it was fantastic. And I said, oh, it was great. And then I said, I think it was really, really well directed. And I had never expressed that thought before as something independent, but it had occurred to me during the movie that someone had liked the Beatles too and interpreted and made it, that there was someone behind it. And I guess that's when it first occurred to me that I would like to see more of this. I would like to do this.
Yeah.
So that was how it happened for me. So it was the movie, since I didn't right away react like I want to be a musician. I didn't play drums or guitar or anything, but I was interested in movies. That was the big step.
Had you ever met Richard Lester?
Yes. Yeah. Before that, he had done It's Trad Dad, which is a little jazz movie. And he had done a short called Running, Jumping, Standing Still, which yes. The Beatles had loved. And if you see in the movie, the sequence where they're on the field to Can't Buy Me Love and they're running around, it's all jump cut. That's pretty much Running, Jumping, Standing Still. It's what the Beatles had responded to. It was a very, very shrewd guess by the producers and a wonderful combination of people in the making of the movie.
So did you feel that Help had sort of gone back to the more exotic world of the films that you'd seen before Hard Day's Night? It wasn't the four ordinary guys who you thought, wow, I could be like that.
Well, by then the Beatles persona had pretty much, because Hard Day's Night set the personas in our mind. So Beatles persona was more prevalent. I think at the time when I saw the movie, I liked it. And I don't think I liked it as much as Hard Day's Night, but I liked the parts that were more Beatly and less this sort of strange James Bondian kind of spies.
Right.
And it was only till I started doing Trailers from Hell and I did that movie that I realized how ultimately disappointing it is compared to Hard Day's Night because of the Ring on Ringo and all that stuff, which is amusing, but there wasn't that intimacy with the Beatles that the first one had, although the songs are great and the song sequences are great. I did like it.
I got to ask you, I believe that Martin Scorsese is a huge fan of Magical Mystery Tour as a film. Has he ever gone and told you why that is?
No. And I remember that coming out, I think when it came out, there was no access to it. It didn't play in theaters right away. And they screened it at the Rock Theater that I was working at the Fillmore East. And so I think we all liked it. I mean, as time has gone on, it doesn't hold up as much. Right. It's certainly the music. Again, the music is great, you know. Its execution is not up to the aspirations of the music.
I think Martin Scorsese had said that he liked something about its experimental nature. And certainly when I think his short films, I'm not sure if they were made for while he was still in university, but they came out on DVD a few years ago. And all of a sudden I thought, well, I don't really like Magical Mystery Tour, but I see the influence. I can see what it maybe did to his way of thinking as a short filmmaker.
His short films preceded Magical Mystery Tour.
Okay.
It's Only You, Murray, which is his NYU project. I think Marty graduated from NYU probably about 63 or 64.
Okay.
And then after that, he made The Big Shave. And then by the time he was teaching at NYU, which is where I first encountered him, I think he had started work on Who's That Knocking at My Door? And
right.
That movie was produced by the head of the NYU Film School, Haig Menuhin, who was Marty's mentor. And I guess Haig helped Marty raise the money or however it was. And so that was a movie they picked up and put down a couple of times as they got more, trying to get distribution, et cetera.
Not to shift gears, but I just wanted to touch on something when you talked about working at the Fillmore. There's something interesting that I've always found from a social perspective. It's like growing up in the 80s and 90s and getting to see like a lot of bands myself in bars, you know, like Nirvana and Soundgarden and the Red Hot Chili Peppers when they were starting up and all these bands. At that time, we never really thought there was anything, you know, significant going on. We were just going to see bands. what I want to ask you is that when you had your whole experience of working at the Fillmore with so many monumental bands, what you've talked about being able to see, I mean, I would kill to see just one night of what you've seen. You know, what I want to ask you is that at that time, and not just in music, but also in your education in film, did you really realize at that time that that was really something significant, like that was monumental, or was it just another night at the Fillmore or another night going to see a foreign film, like a Fellini film or something?
Well, at the time, there was a unification of a generation through the music that we liked and through the films that we liked. And those things were driving the culture. There is nothing now that really drives the culture in the same way. Maybe you can say that's the internet has that role as an entity. But there was this change in the culture that was going on that was part and parcel of the 60s that was part of that responding to as teenagers, as baby boomers. So I was born in 1948. So when the Beatles appeared in 64 on TV, I was 16. So at a very vulnerable age to influences. And as I saw all those movies, I was feeling that they were, what we were experiencing was different than what my parents had experienced. And the music was more so, you know, it was just so expressive of our generation because it was the first music that was being written by the people who were performing it.
Right.
And that made a big difference. You became involved in it and you had a certain, the access to it was narrower. In the sense that if you wanted to see a new band, they would often appear on the Ed Sullivan Show, which was where the Beatles appeared. And you'd see these bands. And everyone tuned into the same radio station. So, for instance, American Graffiti is a perfect example of the unification of a generation behind music. Because they're all listening to the same show as their lives go on. And that's a beautiful illustration of that.
Answer the phone, dummy.
Pinky's Pizza.
Yeah, listen, you got any more of those secret agent spy scopes?
Hip parade on the stethoscope.
No, the secret agent spy scope, man. That pulls in the moon, the stars, the planets, and the satellites, and the spacemen.
You must have the wrong number, partner.
So this is all coming together, and as someone interested in music, you start looking forward to each band's new albums as they come along, and all of a sudden you start hearing about these new bands that are coming on what was, don't forget, FM radio was just starting. FM radio really didn't exist as a format till like 66 or so, 67. Mm-hmm. So all of that excitement is going on. When we were working at a new Stones album, a new Beatles record, you'd hear about a group in San Francisco, and that would be the Jefferson Airplane. So when the Fillmore East opened, I went opening night, and I saw opening act was Albert King. So I was just becoming aware of blues. I really wasn't aware of blues as a separate entity and what it was. Right. Until I heard the Rolling Stones and the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. So my way to that was through a white interpretation. I think by the time the Fillmore opened, I had already seen B.B. King play. And he was so thrilling. And I had heard he was a great guitar player. But what I was not prepared for was what a brilliant song was. And what he was saying, the way he sang and stuff, was not anything I had had exposure to. So opening night to Fillmore, you have Albert King. Then the second act was Tim Buckley, who was Jeffrey's dad. And Tim Buckley had an album out at that point, which was being played a little bit on FM radio. And the headliner was Big Brother and the Holding Company with Janis, who I'd seen twice before that. And so it was exciting to see that. And then 3 weeks later, I think I saw the Jefferson Airplane there and then the Doors. And then, you know, at that point, I had already heard Hendrix because he had been, this is 68. So Hendrix had appeared on the radio in the summer of 67. And I had heard about him because I was working at a radio station in college. And I was reading Billboard magazine, and there was a whole thing about his first single, Hey Joe.
Hey Joe, where you going with that gun of yours?
So right. with us, an excitement of all these new things happening.
Right.
And so when you became, so that was just in the air and that was what was expected. And now when we look at it, it's a very compressed period. The time in real time, like that was just what was going on and everyone paying right. attention to the same thing. So
right.
when I started working there, there were many, many like-minded individuals working at the Fillmore. You didn't pursue that job because it was a good job. You want, you know, that it's not like you were going to be a delivery guy or
no,
whatever.
It was labor of love.
Yes, everyone tried to get those jobs, and when I stumbled into it, once you were there, you said, "I'm not going to give this job up for anything."
No,
and
no,
so
no.
everyone was a rock fan, so there was much, much discussion
right.
about the music. The level of bands was so high that you right. could be critical of Creedence Clearwater by saying, "Well, they just played the same set each night," you know, and who wouldn't die to see that set?
Absolutely, absolutely.
We said, like, the Live Aid show Saturday was pretty good, but it's essentially note for note, the same thing. And so there was this push for people who were even greater and to transcend it in a live situation. I don't know if that answers the question.
No, I get it totally. And there's one thing, not to go forward, but for example, in Get Crazy, all the live acts are so diverse. You know, like you start with, you know, the blues. And
right.
for a lot of people that would see Get Crazy, they would say, well, you know, these bands would never play together, like such a wide range of different acts, right? But the reality is, like you're saying, back at the Fillmore, you did get such a wide range of acts that all played together in one night.
It's an interesting that you say that, because when we previewed the movie with an audience, they complained about the very thing that you just said. The cards came out and said, well, this couldn't happen because these
right.
people would never play together. And
right.
by then, we're in the 80s. So one of the things that killed the Fillmore East was the fact that Bill Graham was not able anymore to book those kinds of shows. To book a show where 10 years after opened, the Staple Singers were on second, and Big Brother was holding company, was on headline. Or here's a show where you have the headliner is Neil Young and Crazy Horse. The second band supporting them is the Steve Miller Band.
Wow.
And the opening band is Miles Davis with the Bitches Brew Orchestra.
Jeez.
and it's 550.
And I think it was actually Lollapalooza that tried to kind of cop on what Bill Graham was doing, too. When they did the Lollapalooza tours in the 90s with all the diversity, like they were trying to go back to that time. And I don't think it was a possibility of going back.
New Orleans Jazz Fest is like that.
Right.
And to some degree, Coachella is within a narrower range.
Right. But I mean, I would have killed just to been able to see like the diversity back then. It's just.
The thing about it was that we were so involved in the music and so involved in that particular world. Like when we saw the Allman Brothers for the first time. They were the opening band. Ahead of them was another band called Lollap called Appaloosa. And the headliner was Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Wow.
Who at that time had big hit records and
right.
stuff. The Allmans could only play for 25 minutes, but they were so impressive. And
right.
from their sound check, they were so great. We all wrote up a petition and gave it to Bill Graham, half a joke, half a real thing, like, bring these guys back, bring these guys back.
Right.
And he brought them back about 8 weeks later. And so the show then was, do you remember an LA group called Love?
Of course, Arthur Lee,
Yeah, My Little Red Book and Alone Again. So they were the opening band. The Allman Brothers were second on the bill, and the headliner was the Grateful Dead. And so the late show would start at 11:30. So they played all night.
And, you know, when you get in a situation like that, too, I find that, like you were talking about the level of musicianship, you know, that everyone had such high standards. But when you get a band like the Allmans that are just, like, killing it, and then they're like, okay, top that. And then the next band actually has to be on their A game because the guys, you know, before them just smoked them.
And also you're in a concert hall situation where the people who worked there had come right out of, and the people who set up the Fillmore Reese in terms of the crew, and had come out of NYU Theater School, because the distance between the Fillmore East and the NYU Theater School was 6 inches. Wow. They were right next door to each other in a quirk of history. Wow. And so when they started taking apart the old Yiddish theater, which was the Lowe's Commodore, and making it into a rock theater, naturally the theater students are like coming next door going, what's going on, and getting jobs there. The ushers and the stage crew were, a lot of us were at NYU Film School, because they had put up a sign saying that they were looking for ushers, and they put that up in the front of the theater and in one of the dorms at NYU. So that's why you had this rush of NYU kids. And so the stage crew itself, we were a little bit insufferable, but it was it was made up of theater students, right, playwrights, and student filmmakers, and we all had opinions. And so as we bonded as a group and experienced all these bands, our standards grew. And there were definitely bands that we loved and bands that we loathed.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but I was going to say it makes perfect sense now what you're saying when you look at Get Crazy at the beginning when Max is coming in on the flying spaceship.
15 years in this place and I still can't get a crew to do it right.
Because that's like a total theater thing. You know, like you can just see theater students building the props and setting that all up. I mean, so I'm like, yeah, okay, I absolutely understand what you're saying.
Yeah, and the manager of the theater who ran it for Bill Graham had been to Carnegie Mellon Theater School. And Joshua White, who ran the Joshua Light Show, had also been to Carnegie Mellon. So there was these people who had an educational experience about classical theater were now being able to express that in a rock and roll setting. And Bill Graham's big decision was whether he was going to move into New York and have rock theater, but it was going to be theatrical. That was a huge decision because it had only been dance hall stuff before that. The Fillmore West was a dance hall, you know. There wasn't a ordered presentation of a group in a... There was, like, they would announce them, but it wasn't as formal an announcement. I'm not making it really formal, but, like, when you walked in the Fillmore East and you saw... And you were coming in through the lobby, straight ahead on the light show screen would be bathed in one color. There'd be one light show effect, and there'd be a slide that said, "Welcome to the Fillmore East," and Joshua Light Show under it. It was like a visual playbill.
Right.
And in fact, for many years, he gave out playbills. That's how much it was still in the traditional system.
Wow.
So then when the show was about to start and Bill or whoever was going to announce the first band or a band would come on, they'd say the name of the band. The band's name would appear on the screen. As the band started playing and the light show started going, it would go away. And at the end of their act, as they went off the stage, their name would appear. And then when they came back for an encore, name would come on again. So there was a sense of structure to the evening and a presentation, made for the bands to realize that being in New York, that was the height of the touring, and that was the best sound and the best lighting. You were playing the big top.
Now, this might sound like a stupid question, but when everybody was trying to bring such a theatrical presentation to all of it, did they ever consider like filming any of this for like archival purposes or like documenting any of it on film?
Well, there's Amelie Rothschild's book of called, I think it's called Welcome to Fillmore East, which is part of her hundreds of photos that she took at the Fillmore. And those are the photos that you see everywhere. And then Amelie got a hold of an early video camera and filmed Jimi Hendrix on New Year's Eve, the late show, him doing his whole set with the band of Gypsies.
Is that the stuff that just came out? I think that just came out recently.
I bought it about 15 years ago as a bootleg. I was in a record store in the West Village, and I hear, you know, Band of Gypsies playing, and oh, I know this show. I was at this show, and now I'm looking through records. I look up at the TV set, and so I go up to the desk, and I say, is this the Fillmore East, 1969, 1970 on New Year's Eve? And the guy's like, whoa. I said, I was there, and it was a bootleg of Amelie's tape. Then it wasn't even the whole show on that bootleg. Then a couple of years later, they put it out on VHS as a documentary where people talking about Hendrix. And now it's out on DVD. You can get it with the documentary and you can get the whole show on the same DVD.
Is that the one with the Cabot interviews on it?
No, this one is just called Jimi Hendrix Live at the Fillmore, I think.
Oh, okay, because I think there's a documentary called Jimi Hendrix, because I've seen it before, the one when he's on the Dick Cavett show and he's being interviewed.
Right.
Is that the one where he's playing the acoustic version of Hear My Train A-Comin'? Is that documentary?
That's yet another Hendrix documentary. There's a bunch of them. And then there's like Rainbow Bridge and some other stuff, which is the concert in Hawaii that he did. Now, there was also a filming of a TV show, which you can see on YouTube, called Welcome to the Fillmore East, which was done for PBS. And it's very interesting because you can see that it has all of us in it who worked there, setting up the show and changing the marquee and so forth. And then a part of a show, and it's the Byrds and Van Morrison, etc.
Wow.
So that one for PBS. There was a movie called Who is Harry Kellerman and Why is He Saying These Things About Me with Dustin Hoffman.
Yep.
And they filmed the scene at the Fillmore for that. That was about it that I know of. There's probably more. Every once in a while, you see a little piece of film show up, which was shot there from a news show.
But like you were saying about things being in the vaults in the past, things coming out, you'll never know. Maybe there were other people there that had shot stuff, and suddenly things come out. Because now they're finding film prints of things, like, for example, like that Metropolis print that they found down in South America, and they thought it was long gone. You never know where things just come up out of nowhere again, and oh my God, you know, we suddenly have footage or something. This monumental.
Well, it's not quite on the level of Metropolis, but my student film was shot in the Fillmore East. And it's about the rise and fall of a rock star in 1 week. And I put together the star of it was one of the guys on the stage crew who helped me write it. His name is John Ford Noonan. And actually, John just passed away about 4 days ago, five days ago.
Sorry.
And so Bill Graham let me use the theater to film in for no cost. And members of the crew chipped in to help me connect the cables for the lighting and the Joshua Light Show appear in it. I put together a band to back this thing. And so it was all filmed in the Fillmore. So you can see the place. It's not a famous band or anything, but that was really, really, I will forever be in Bill's debt for letting me do that.
That's something that's amazing for me on the other side of the world. I mean, I've heard all these great albums recorded at the Fillmore East or the Fillmore West for that matter. I mean, we've got, you know, venues here in Melbourne that we prize and treasure, but there seems to be something magical about the Fillmore above anything else that I've heard of around the world.
Well, the sound system was state of the art, was so far ahead of what had happened before. Now, think about this. When the Beatles played Shea Stadium, that's now we're talking 66 or so.
Right.
All the Beatle tour stuff, they either had a tiny PA on stage or they pumped the Beatles through the sound system that they announced the baseball games with.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
So we're talking like the Dark Ages.
Right.
And all of a sudden you have a theatrical presentation that needs a sound system. And all these people who know about theater start trying to get an idea, how do you do a sound system for a live rock band? And before that, there was no formal way. There was knowledge about it, and people had done it in Fillmore West. But now these theater geeks started arranging how it would sound, along with people who had just started to do rock tours. So they really took the concept of it and refined it. And they were the first ones to actually put speakers up in the air so that they would aim directly at the balcony. No one had ever thought of this before. You know, now it's every concert you go to, there was, you know, speakers up high and speakers down low. And they started tuning the sound system, which no one had ever done for frequencies. And then as they got more and more into it, they started tuning the theater and putting up padding and checking the theater for pink noise and white noise and so forth. So when bands played there, it would sound as good as it was ever going to sound with great monitors. It's only 2,700 seats, so the feedback was great, you know, in terms of being right by the audience. Right. You were presented the way you looked and everything. You had no worries. You were going to look as good as you were. So that was, everything was right for doing a great performance. And you played four times in one weekend. So you had played a Friday night early show, which was always the one where they were the most tense and excited. Then there'd be Friday night late show, which was usually really, really good because everyone was loose by now and they'd been on the stage. The Saturday night early show was hungover show because everyone was still waking. Right. But right. The Saturday night late show was when everyone cut loose because there was no curfew. Once you're on the late show, you could play as long as you want. And there was no sense of, well, the second group can't play longer than that because the headliner, none of that existed yet.
Wow. Here's a question for you that I'm not sure about, but it's maybe it's a stretch. But in Get Crazy, was it your decision to cast Alan Garfield? Because I just wondered, because now I look at him and it seems to me like he's almost like the representation of Bill Graham. You know, I remember looking at him from the conversation, from Coppola's conversation, and, you know, so many films I see him as the little powerhouse. To me, he really held the role as Max. I just loved him in that.
You know, this is so much later, I can just say what really happened. Almost every role of an actor in there was an argument with the producers. The producer basically just kept, it was his goal to challenge me, it felt like, over and over again. And who I wanted to play him, Bill, was Jerry Orbach.
Wow.
Now, you know, Jerry on Law and Order.
Right.
He looks exactly like Bill. He's from the theater, you know.
Right.
He was
a
song and dance man. That's who I wanted. And for instance, the little actor, right, who gets Lou Reed sings to at the end.
Right.
And Tracy did a really good job. But my first choice was Mariska Hargitay.
Okay.
Who is now the star of Law & Order SVU. She was a young actress. She was 18 years old. She came in red. She was I was glad you tried to get Alan to be as much like Bill as I remembered. He didn't quite get there, but it's okay.
How did Lou Reed come into it?
Ain't got all day. Hey, man, it's dark out there. What's going on?
Night.
Night? What time is it?
20 to 12.
20 to 12? I've got a show to do. Step on it.
The character of Auden.
Yeah.
Now, I'm trying to think. I thought there was only a couple people that can do it. Obviously, Dylan was not going to do it. So I tried to think of someone who had that kind of stature. And I think that maybe Lou Reed was the first choice. He was really the first rocker to sign on. We flew to New York to meet with him, and we took him out to lunch to the Russian Tea Room and told him about the story of the film. It was him and his wife of the time, Sylvia Morales. Mm-hmm. And I think Lou was impressed that I was so aware of his music. And we talked a lot about the Blue Mask. And, you know, I mentioned the early stuff, but he was really impressed how much I knew about his music. It was not just the hits like Walk on the Wild. It was all the difficult music.
Right, everything. Done. Yeah.
I think he said yes at lunch. And then we flew to Chicago to meet with our first choice for King Blues. You guys know this?
No, I don't know this story. No.
The first choice for King Blues was Muddy Waters.
The gypsy woman told my mother before I was born, you got a boy child coming, gonna be a son of a gun.
Oh, wow.
I know.
And the last choice.
And we met Muddy at the Chicago airport. And he came walking towards us, and he was wearing these sort of golf pants, these brown acrylic golf pants and a Hawaiian shirt. And he gave off such a vibe. I mean, people didn't know who he was, but they knew he was somebody. And we sat down. I think his daughter was with him. And his daughter and I and us, we talked, and Muddy hadn't read the script, but we told him the story and what we were trying to do with the character of King Blues and put a character in there in which all rock and roll comes from. That's why everybody does Hoochie Coochie Man. That's the point. And at the end of the conversation, he looked at me and he looked at his daughter and he said, I believe this young man is telling the truth and I'd like to do this movie. So he was signed up to do the movie, and then he had developed his heart trouble got worse. So he had to bow out. And that's how we got the guy that we got. And the parts that were the hardest to cast was Captain Cloud. We tried to get Dr. John to do it, a bunch of different people, but that didn't work. And that's when we came up with the idea of one of the guys from Flo and Eddie. I don't remember who recommended, but Howard was perfect.
Yeah, he's great in that.
Howard Bart was the Nada band.
Right, right.
Nada. And where I got the idea from that was there was a really good nightclub in New York on 12th Street and 3rd Avenue, somewhere around there. And that's where a lot of bands played. They had a Christmas show every year where all the locals would come and do songs. And there was a lot of women who got together and did covers of great songs, and they formed together as a group so they could sing their favorite songs. And it was so much fun watching them. That's where I got the idea of them being a band that existed and them having a pet that they kept with them on a chain, and that was Iggy Pop. And that was, of course, who we
Lee
got.
Wings.
Yeah. Here's who we offered it to. We offered it to the B-52s. They said no. To the Roche Sisters, they said no. I think we offered it to Joan Jett. Was she around then? Yes. Almost every female singer said no until we saw a video of Laurie Eastside. Who at that time was a backup singer and a dancer with Kid Creole and the Coconuts.
Right.
And she projected so much personality that she got the part, and then everyone else was cast out of LA musicians who were playing in different bands.
Yeah, it was funny because, like, when you see Decline of the Western Civilization, like the first one with Fear in that, and you see, like, Lee Ving, man, like, you know, that guy's undeniable. And he's, like, been a character actor in so many different films, like Dudes. Right. Yeah, I've actually had the opportunity to meet him, and the guy's a sweetheart. He's a great guy.
Just to sort of make another filmic connection, you mentioned that you tried to get the B-52s, Forget Crazy, but it looks like they appeared with Lou Reed and with Alan Garfield in a film that I think came a couple of years early. That was Paul Simon's
One Trick Pony. And Blair Brown, One Trick Pony, a film from Warner Brothers.
Opens Friday at the Uptown Theater in 35mm Dolby Stereo.
Oh, was that before Get Crazy or
that
after?
Was 1980. Yeah, yeah. I remember getting the record when that came out.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely playing it to death. I didn't get to see the film until many years later. And to be honest with you, I'm still not sold on it as a great film. I know that there's an honest story in there to be told.
I remember seeing it, but I don't remember anything about it.
It was a story about the working life of a musician as Paul Simon saw it. So there's maybe that level of honesty, but I think, you know, as a script writer, he's a fantastic songwriter. I wanted to actually sort of change tack a little bit go talk about a couple of films that I know that you've spoken about on Trailers from Hell. Well, actually, one in Trailers from Hell and one film that you've spoken about in your own sort of personal biography. So I think it's often been said that The Girl Can't Help It is one of the first rock and roll films, if not the first rock and roll film. If she walks by the men folk getting gross, if she winks an eye, red lights turn to tone, if she got a lot of what they call the moan. And it was on my list of shame. I actually sort of only watched it for the first time maybe about a month ago. So my bad, but I finally got around to it. And I'm wondering, does it really qualify as a rock and roll film? We can't sort of underestimate the importance of having people like, you know, Little Richard and Eddie Cochran, you know, exposed at a time to the cinema audience when, you know, it would have otherwise sort of been hard for them. And yet, when watching that film, it's almost like the Torch song wins the day and the values are still your parents' conservative values, and rock and roll is still sort of seen as something trivial, which guess it would be for many years to come.
Well, yet the real, I mean, Frank Tashlin, who is a great director, he's of a different generation. And in a way, since he was not just as a director, he was an observer of the social scene. He always was a satirist of what was going on. And you can see that in his Jerry Lewis movies. And you could see that in his cartoons, which he was a director of cartoons for Warner Brothers, for Looney Tunes. Hence his usage of gags and stuff that were cartoon-like and bringing that over into movies. So in a way, he actually has a kind of love-hate relationship with music. I think he liked the anarchy of it and the fun of it, but I don't think he bought it as something worthy of the culture that he represented. I don't think there's any, and I can be corrected about this, I don't think there's any music movie of that particular era. You know, you're talking about the 50s into the early 60s that in any way presents the music as it was. You know, if you look at all those AIP type movies like Rock All Night and all of that, everyone watching the bands is sitting at tables
in a nightclub
and like what looks like prom dresses with no reaction. You know, the biggest reaction I think you see in a movie now that I think about it is High School Confidential. When Jerry Lee Lewis arrives at the high school, which was one of the inspirations for Rock and Roll High School, and everyone's dancing around him. But there was none of that. If they presented the artist, they presented him in the most sterile possible way because they didn't know better. They were taking it from TV variety shows, and the fans were dead on their feet, you know. Just no sense of it. Obviously, what I liked, Girl Can't Help It, I liked it's playing with the form, the beginning of it where it stretches it into CinemaScope. And I think I liked how he shot the music. It was so imaginative. Julie London, you know, singing Cry Me a River. Joey Ramone singing I Want You Around.
I want you around.
And if you look at them side by side, there's many of the same jokes and many of the same ideas. And then later on, I did Shake, Rattle, and Rock, and Renee Zellweger's, there's a whole dance and thing to The Girl Can't Help It as my homage to it. So those were the kinds of movies that were around. And Rock and Roll High School is essentially a remake of Shake, Rattle, and Rock, which is the kids who want rock and roll, the school hates the music, and it ends up in a trial where they put the rock and roll on trial. So when I did the version of Shake, Rattle, and Rock that I did in 1995, I basically lifted the entire plot. It's a closer homage than Rock and Roll High School was.
The other film I sort of wanted to get some more thoughts from you, and this is one that you mentioned, I think you devoted like a whole segment to your love of The Who and your biography videos, and I was so thrilled to see you bring out a copy of The Kids Are All Right.
Roger from Oz, what's the next song you're gonna do?
My Generation.
Your Generation?
Yeah.
Well, I can really identify with that because I really identify with these guys. I dig them. And this is a...
Which is a film I've seen more times than I care to remember, and was actually even privileged to have seen it on the big screen. Even got to see it at a revival house here in Melbourne. And yet, it's far from being your conventional documentary. There's no narration. There's no sense of telling a story from start to finish. They go from this video clip to that video clip to a bit of an interview here and Keith Moon being whipped by a dominatrix there. And yet you come out and you really get an idea of what The Who are all about and who they were, which may not have been possible if it had been a more conventional documentary. So just want to get some of your thoughts about The Kids Are All Right, and could that have been made as a conventional documentary?
Yeah, I saw that very early on because I think New World Pictures distributed it. And so I saw an early screening of it, and I got to know Jeff Stein, who directed it. And Jeff became a really great rock video director. He's one of the top video directors of the 80s. I love the fact that there's no narration or anything like that. And I've shown it to my kids a lot. They are the Smothers Brothers. Yep. It's holistic. They were like 9, 10 years old. Thought it was hilarious. He said, I'm Roger from Oz and all that kind of stuff, you know. So I think that also the concert presentations of Keith Moon are really powerful because now we know it's the last time we would ever see Keith Moon.
Right.
And I thought the way that Jeff filmed Won't Get the Gannon Bob O'Reilly really exciting and much, much more exciting, cynic and showing of love for than you usually find in something shot on a soundstage. You know, those feel like live performances. And the intensity is there. And Jeff had grown up in the New York area, and he had been someone who had come to the Fillmore East. He was at the Fillmore East the night that the theater caught fire during the Who's first show of Tommy. He was in that audience.
Wow.
And so Jeff and I talked about it.
One thing I find interesting with music movies is that in the 80s, you know, I wouldn't officially call them grindhouses, but I remember when a lot of the repertoire cinemas would have the all-nighters on the weekends, on Friday and Saturday nights, and it was almost like they were trying to replicate, like, you know, what went on at the Fillmore, because we'd get to see The Song Remains the Same, and then we'd get to see maybe Tommy or The Kids Are All Right, or they would show, you know, all that. Like, all night would be, like, three or four music films, and then they'd show Enter the Dragon, you know, like, at about 4 a.m., but it's just this whole thing about where it's almost like they were trying to replicate that whole experience, you know, with the music movies.
Is everybody in? Is everybody in? The ceremony is about to begin.
A film that we spoke about on the show earlier on this year was The Doors, and I'd successfully avoided actually watching the film till earlier on this year.
The Oliver Stone. Oliver Stone one,
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, I grew up, you know, being a big fan of the music of The Doors, and, you know, I'd read No One Here Gets Out Alive, but I'd heard that, you know, the film sort of presented him very one-dimensionally, and, you know, pretty much watching it the start of this year, you know, for the show, made me think, all that I'd heard had been correct, and, you know, Jim was just presented as this drugged out, inconsiderate asshole, and there was none of the clever, the witty guy that Ray Manzarek had always claimed him to be. But one thing that you said in your Trailers from Hell discussion about it was that the concert sequences were magnificent, and I think all of us on the show absolutely 100% agreement with that. It was so, just sort of like taking it from The Doors to your own work, do you find that preparing a concert sequence is a lot more difficult than anything else that you might have included in the movie? So, like, say, for instance, you know, the concert sequence in Rock and Roll High School, where, you know, they actually get out to see the Ramones, or anything, and Get Crazy, it just looks like it'd be such incredibly hard work.
It is hard work, and there's an intensity to it. And I think in Rock and Roll High School, even though I actually found my shot list, there were camera moves that were indicated at certain parts of the song. But mostly you were trying to capture what was happening in front of you. And the audience was the Ramones fans. The audience had to pay to be in the movie. That's all we could afford. And in Get Crazy, I took my first AD to see Iggy at the Palladium, and I took the art department and some of the other crew members, and that's what the kind of energy I was trying to get. And my first AD had mostly done Westerns. He had been the AD on The Wild Bunch. Wow. So he started to understand the intensity of what I was trying to go for. And he said that he could definitely get the punks worked up into that kind of frenzy. Later on, as I became better at filming, for instance, I started doing Fame, I started designing. Since it was not a concert situation necessarily, I started designing my music numbers and camera moves here and shooting it from multiple cameras. It's kind of like the way it's a difference between Rocky and Raging Bull, you know. In Rock High School, it was more like Rocky, you know. It's like, here's the fight, and I'm going to shoot it from all these angles at once, and we'll cut it together. You know, in Raging Bull, there is none of that. There is every camera move counts, especially in doing Fame, where every episode, and I did like 14 of them, there would be three or four music numbers. I was trying to express the story within the song, okay? And in Rock and Roll High School, the story within the song was something as simple as I Don't Want to Be a Pinhead nor DUMB, you know, kind of. But later on, if you look at my Fame episodes, there are elaborate storylines that tell the story of the song. Mm. Dancing, I did a whole tribute to cowboy movies and Westerns through Dan. So as moving past that, you get into the Temptations movie.
It's going to open up on
I've got sunshine on a cloudy day.
I'm Otis Williams. I got this singing group. Your voice knocks me out.
which is even more sophisticated because I learned that you don't want to stop the narrative to play the song. The narrative continues through the song. The best action movies are like a movie, like, say, French Connection. If there's an action scene, it continues the story and advances the story. And the music songs have to do that. There has to be a point of view and a dramatic action that is resolved or illustrated during the songs. And in the Temptations movie, just about every song, and there's like 30 of them, is storytelling. You see the relationship with the group on stage, what's going on in their lives, and then the challenge was, how do we get that across when the recorded version doesn't contain this drama? The recorded version was like, here's the best that we can see. So we actually, that's why we re-recorded some of the Temptation songs at great peril, because they're classics, to give it the edge of what was needed dramatically to tell the story.
And Otis was okay with it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That was because the producer of the Temptations movie was Suzanne DePass, who had worked at Motown, you know. So when we did I'm Losing You, we did it with more funk and more anger because we presented it in a situation where David Ruffin was basically telling the group, get lost. I don't need you.
Right.
So it needed that built in, you know. So the acting begins in the recording studio so that it ends up on the screen now. We did not change My Girl. You just can't. And the one place it kind of bumped was the song worked great is Ain't Too Proud to Beg, but Ain't Too Proud to Beg fades out, and we used it as a live performance. So we tried adding a little musical ending on it so it felt like it ended. So we did about every possible way you could to present the music so that it helped advance the story.
One part of that film that just absolutely blew me away, and I'm thinking it was partly your visual style from maybe the few rock video clips that you'd gone and recorded in the 80s, but your segment of them in the studio doing Papa Was a Rolling Stone.
It was the 3rd of September, that day I'll always remember, yes I will. Cause that was the day that my daddy died. I never got a chance to see him. Never heard nothing but bad.
Just thought,
yes,
the visual flair on that just blew me away. That's so fantastic.
I'm glad you point that out because I don't get to talk enough about that. And that is probably one of the best things I've ever directed when I look at it. It was always the centerpiece to the film once the script started moving along. And I remember the first time I heard the song, how floored I was by it and how much I loved it over the years. And as the story of the band was coming along, I realized that what the song is saying is about their lives. And if it isn't a rock band or a group like that, it's a basketball team or a baseball team. It's when men go out away from their homes and live together and work together towards a common goal. And what they're doing can be interpreted as play, right? Mm. You mean you get paid to play basketball? You mean you get paid to sing songs? And that bonding and that behavior was significant and what the movie is about. And so when we realized that, and in getting that set up with NBC, NBC at that point had been extremely successful with their sweeps movies. And they always used to put on a miniseries during sweeps, and they were usually very elaborate effects-driven ones that this organization did. And they were magical or whatever it was. And this one was musical. And so when I was pitching it to them, I said, the songs are going to be your effect sequences. And I want to do a song in the center that is the big effect. Effects sequence, so to speak, the one that is the most elaborate. And I told them that I was going to do this whole song and have no dialogue, that the song would tell the story and it'd be very special. And when I did my shot list for it, what we decided to do was throughout filming, we would film pieces from certain scenes that would be in that. So if we were in a dressing room set, that's when I shot the stuff of David doing dressing room things. And it was something I had experimented with on Shake, Rattle, and Rock, was shooting dialogue instead of 24 frames a second, 12 frames a second, and printing it twice. So you get that staccato effect.
Right.
And the abusive, you know, father, the abusive member of the band who was drunk all the time, arguing stuff, but you didn't have to hear what he said. It looked very stylized, but you understood the anger and the angst of it. And in between that, it was a very specific interpretation of how that song is built. One of the things I like best in the great music biographies is when they explain the music to you and how they... A great example of that is the one about Brian Wilson. You come away understanding that music. And very, very often, you just see the music. The worst example is Jersey Boys. It's just the guy singing Four Seasons songs. There is no sense of how those songs are structured or what inspired them to make them. There's very little sense of that in the Freddie Mercury movie that's out now.
Right, right.
Right.
And so Pop Was a Rolling Stone was a way of putting together what that song meant to their lives and telling the story of Papa going bad and killing himself. You know, the story of Paul Williams. Yeah. So it was a very conscious attempt to do a larger, longer narrative. And one of the great creative days of my life was I had sent all the footage to my editor. We were shooting in Pittsburgh, and he had done different rough cuts. But he and I sat down at 8 in the morning, and we only had 13 days to edit this whole miniseries. And we sat down at 8 in the morning and started working on Papa. And by, I don't think we got up till like, you know, 7 or 8 that night. And we cut the whole thing together, just focused on it. And when we were very nervous when we sent it over to NBC. And they just loved it. They flipped over it. They thought it was amazing. And they kept telling other, you know, shows, do like when they did the show about the 70s, do a Papa's a Rolling Stone kind of thing. And it's one of the things I'm most proud of.
That's awesome.
Sorry, it was such a long-winded answer.
No, we love long-winded answers.
Actually, like when you just mentioned the Freddie Mercury film, is there anything that you've seen in recent years in terms of music movies that has really struck you, Alan?
I love the documentary. He was an engineer and a producer for Atlantic Records. Tom Dowd, yep.
Okay.
You know, he was the engineer on all the great Atlantic sides throughout the 50s into the 60s. And then he was the producer. He was engineer on Cream's Disraeli Gears. And then he produced Allman Brothers Records, and he produced Live at the Fillmore East and Layla. And his story, I thought, was fascinating. And I highly recommend the documentary about him. I like the one about Muscle Shoals.
Yeah, we love that one. Yeah.
I thought that the recent Queen one was very nothing. I mean, it was fine. It was just a straightforward telling of the story, you know.
Right.
Anything that Jonathan Demme was involved with had a great sense. The two Neil Young things he did, well, not the two Neil Young, but the one he did.
Stop Making Sense. I've always loved that.
Well, Stop Making Sense is the definitive concert film. And that's one of the great ones, along with The Last Waltz, because they're filmmakers finding a way for the camera to help illuminate the music. And there's like a shot in Stop Making Sense during Burning Down the House that whips all around, and just by what it focuses on, makes you understand what is going on that stage between the musicians. Scorsese always does that. You know, when you look at Scorsese's Rolling Stones, Shine a Light, just what the camera captured is going on between those members of that band tells you how the Rolling Stones music works when it's being played live. Get that DVD and look at watch Hot, 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 which is not a really well-known Stones song. It's about the fourth song in that concert. And you can see the first couple songs are really good. It's the Stones. They can't screw up anymore. They're really good. But when Hot, Hot, Hot comes on, and about halfway during the first verse, and Keith is doing that call and response of playing a lick and mix singing, you see it lock in. see the look between Keith and Ron Wood, and you can see them lock into this, and they jump literally to a higher level as the chorus starts. And from that chorus on, you see that band at a whole, at the level of greatness that they can achieve. Right. And when the song goes right into going down the line, they don't stop. They have reached that transcendent level that you want a band to reach. And it's the transcendent of the Allmans live at the Fillmore Reese. It's the transcendent of the Who at times live. Right. All
what
those
you're talking about, the transcendence, for me, the one footage that I've seen that to me captures that is Alvin Lee at Woodstock. I'm going home.
Yes. There is an expression I use sometimes that for the length of the set, when a band reaches its potential and then goes beyond it, I always say to my kids or whatever friends, they are the greatest band in the world right now. And it's a wonderful thing, a privilege to see that happen, you know, and it doesn't always happen. You know, Springsteen certainly has had that happen more than most people. The Zeppelin on some of those cuts on that DVD that has their concerts and all that in it. The Who, when they did Tommy at the Fillmore Reese, certainly saw it.
That footage from the Isle of Wight when they do the Young Man's Blues.
Yes.
Well, a young man ain't got nothing in the world these days.
That's just like, man, like they're not even there. That's what I always say. They're not even there. They're there, but they're not there.
I've mentioned that before, places, that that's one of the Transcendent Who films.
Oh, yeah.
I think if you look at the performance in that, that's amazing. Santana at Woodstock. The performance at Woodstock that towers in a certain way because it is on the verge of madness. It's so intense. It's Joe Cocker. It's him with the grease band at Woods doing a little help from my friend.
Right.
And it's basically one shot. He is so into what he's doing and so gone. At one point, he drops out of the frame. He's so insane, you know.
Right.
And the cameraman's like, where did he go? And he pops up into the frame.
Right.
We're speaking before about what you really loved about Love and Mercy, the Brian Wilson film of a couple of years ago, was the fact that they focused on the music rather than Brian's creativity being a side issue to the story of, you know, all the difficulties that he faced.
Brian.
I love that.
Brian.
Yeah.
I think you might have screwed up here.
Really? Let me see.
Well, you've got Lyle playing in D and the rest of us are in A major.
Yeah, that's right.
How does that work? Two bass lines and two different keys?
Well, it works in my head. I mean, it's all playing in my head, the orchestration and the five vocal parts. I think it's going to work. Let's try it.
Al, here's how I want you to do it. Goes, boom, two, three, four, ba-doom. So it's the first beat on the last bar of the intro. Boom, two, three, four.
They decide to tell two stories from a short period of time rather than sort of like, say, right, in 2 hours we're going to give you 40 years of the Beach Boys or 40 years of Brian Wilson. We'll tell you two stories and weave in and out. And some of the films that I've really thought have been successful about a band or a performer have been one that have focused on one story within their period of time. So Backbeat from the early 90s is more about the relationship between John Lennon and Stuart Sutcliffe. Do you remember that film, Alan?
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes music movies are much better when they just keep it to a defined length of time. Because the basic stories, you know, going back to the Doors movie, it's always the same. What's interesting is the rise and the discovery, and then the successful, and then there's the degeneration and the fall.
Right.
You know?
Right.
That's why the Doors movie's first half is a lot more fun than the second half. There's also a certain goofiness in the Doors movie, like when they write Light My Fire. It's as corny as writing a song in a classic Hollywood musical.
I call it Light My Fire. Figure if I'm going to compete with your stuff, it better be about Earth, snakes, or fire. So.
I like it. Sounds like the Birds, though, man. But I like it. I like it. It's good. A little Latin beat will do it some justice.
Maybe put a couple start long over, solos over, like
just start over.
Like Coltrane did on My Favorite Thing.
Start over, man.
Yeah, A minor, B minor, jazz.
Yeah, man, yeah.
You know, George Gershwin, we're thinking of Rhapsody in Blue, you know.
Yes.
But it's goofy, but it's fun. But once he becomes a bad alcoholic, it's less interesting.
Right. Mm-hmm. We've got a friend of the show who works as a script editor, and he's been telling us about this film, which they're still waiting to get the green light from. But it focuses on a story about Joe Strummer, who like was in the midst of the hurricane that was the Clash. And I think management went and told him and his girlfriend to just go away for a weekend and to get his head together because he was so frazzled by the success of the Clash. And the film that they're going to make is just about that weekend, and that me sounds so fascinating. I'm thinking, wow, that'll be great. It'll be more of a character piece.
What's the name of the other guy? Mick Jones.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Mick Jones's relationship with the woman from The Slits. The guitar player.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Yes, she's written an excellent book called Music, 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 Close, 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 Boys, 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 something like that.
Yep.
I highly recommend her book. It's one of the best rock bios I've ever read, as is the one from Sleater Kinney, her book. She's an actress now.
Portlandia? Portlandia? You mean, her name, from Portlandia?
Yeah, that's a really great book. I hear that she has directed it, a pilot for a TV series based on it. And both of them are much, much more revealing about the emotions and what they went through than the majority of the rock bios. I mean, so many rock bios are bragging, you know, about the excess. The Rod Stewart one is that. Whereas the Keith Richards one I like a lot because he explains what he heard in the music when he started and how long it took him to understand that it wasn't just the chords, it was the tuning. And when he gets into the how the music is made stuff, it's very, very interesting. I enjoyed the Clapton one and the Pete Townsend one. I never realized what an insane workaholic Townsend was till I read his book, where it's like you can understand why his life fell apart in a lot of ways because he was driving himself so hard. Mm. So,
yeah. Before we go, just on a side note, I just wanted to say I really, really wanted to thank you and Mr. Dante for the Trailers from Hell.
Whether it's mine or not, here's my admission, guys. If I could do nothing else for the rest of my life, I would do Trailers from Hell every day.
Hello, I'm Alan Arkush, and this is Trailers from Hell.
Absolutely.
Do you want me to go through the process a little bit?
Please, absolutely.
Well, how it works is this. I won't go into the history of it because maybe you'll interview Joe and he'll be able to do that. Okay, so once you're involved and Joe has you on the list of people, he will give you a phone call and he'll say, or send you an email and say, okay, we're going to film in 3 weeks. And these are the 2 days we're filming on, and it's filmed in his house in the living room.
Okay.
And we're in front of a green screen. You know, he'll say, pick 5 movies, and he used to send the list of all the movies that had been picked, but he doesn't do that anymore. But so anyway, pick 5 movies, and then those who know, we would often send an email back and say, pick the movies you want to do. It isn't always 5. We would send back an email, great, is there anything that you need? Because he may have 2 Sidney Lumet movies and needs a 3rd to do a week of programming. There's a bunch of films that he has that have never been presented because they're odd and they don't fit into the programming idea. He needs to make the week out of it.
Right.
You know how each week has a theme. So that'll be the first thing. And he'll say, yeah, I need this, or I'll need, you know, I need another Mario Bava or another Jimmy Stewart or whatever it is. So then I start thinking about what movies I'd like to do. And which one? I often think about my favorite movies. So then the thing is, okay, so I'll write down the favorite movies and then I'll go on YouTube and try and find the trailers, or I will have the DVD already and look at the trailer and see what it's like and see if it's suitable. Sometimes the trailers, if it's like a Hitchcock movie, he's going to talk the whole time. So for me, that's not that interesting. So you find the movies and you come up with a list of, I always try to have a classic movie, a more contemporary movie, an oddball movie, a variety of things. Mm-hmm. And lately I've been doing a lot of Brian De Palma movies because I find that it's easy to talk about them and there is so much critical back and forth about De Palma. People like him or hate him. So you pick the themes and then the fun part happens. You start to read about the director and the movie. Now, I have a library of books about directors, so I start with that, and then you go online and find all the information, and then I take notes about, oh, that I didn't know that before, and I didn't know that Howard Hawks thought that Only Angels Have Wings was his most realistic movie. I went, there is nothing realistic about that movie. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And it's because he based it on some real people that existed. So now you're starting to get a theme. And so in the case of Only Angels Have Wings, the theme is movies that are made in Hollywood, USA. They don't exist in the real world. You know, they exist in Hollywood. And I return to that theme with different movies, like I did The Letter with Bette Davis. It's another example of that kind of movie.
Right.
That is not Singapore.
No.
That is not Singapore. Perfect. Right. It's as much Singapore as Rick's Cafe is Casablanca, you know.
Right.
But
right.
It is Casablanca. Well, I come up with a theme and start writing the intro. Present the theme in the intro, and now I've got all these facts laid out, these little bits of information, try to establish some sort of pattern to it, and read it alongside the trailer.
Wow.
So that I see how it fits together and I go, well, that doesn't fit. And this is way too long. I got to move this up so it seems like the footage matches what's going on. So you kind of hone it that way. The hardest for me is memorizing the intro. It just flies out of my head. And so Joe has set up now a teleprompter so we can actually can read our intros because some of them myself get pretty intricate. Other people, it's very simple. But I really try then to make it so that when the trailer is going, I'm reading it off a sheet, right? And I practice it enough, I know where to pause so that the action can happen. So in a way, very often the ones that I do, you don't have to edit anything. You just slip it on there, you know, and it all works out. And it's just fun for me. It's 3 to 5 days to do one, and we do them for nothing. So.
Right. Well, you know, like this is really important to me because, like, I have a background in history, and to me, archivism is really, really important. Are you familiar with the work of Studs Terkel?
Not really.
He captured more verbal histories of people. You know, he would take a subject, like, for example, he did a book called Work, where he just talked about working, what it's like to work, and he got the perspectives of so many different people. Or he did a book called The Great War and talked about, you know, everyone involved in all the different countries and everything. And he actually just had people's perspectives.
Right.
That's a very important thing when it comes to film from the 60s and 70s and 80s now, because I think a lot of things have been cast aside, and I think a lot of things have been just left to the wayside, and it's important to archive these things and to show the relevance.
And exactly, and then that's why when Larry Karaszewski is just great at finding, you know, his taste is so wide-ranging in what he's seen. He will very often put up films that nobody has seen or no one has thought about them that way.
Right.
And then every once in a while, I'll realize, like I did when I did Goodfellas. I was shocked that no one had done Goodfellas yet, you know?
Right.
So I came up with the concept of it's a kind of film that if you come across it on cable, you're going to stop, watch 5 minutes yourself. I'm just going to watch till he goes into the copa. I want to see that shot that goes through the copa kitchen. And then you go, then you end up watching the whole thing. I call those movies with gravitational pull. So that was my theory.
Right.
On Goodfellas work, you know.
Right.
And then when I was also surprised that no one had done Shampoo. And when I got into the reading about Shampoo, I realized how unique the pre-production was on it and how much of it Warren Beatty paid for and how no one wanted to make that movie. So to tell the story of that movie became relatively easy. When I did the trailer for Shop Around the Corner, I was looking for a Lubitsch.
Yep.
Joe had already done To Be or Not to Be, and I couldn't find trailers for some of my favorite Lubitsch movies, but I found when I saw the Shop Around the Corner one, it's one of those trailers where the actor talks to the camera. I decided I would make it my tribute to Lou Bitch and tell as much as I could about what made him great and discuss what exactly was the Lou Bitch touch, and then let the scenes play between the actors and talk about how, because the trailer has talking to the camera, then it has a whole scene, part of a scene. And then at the end, Lou Bitch appears. So it's the perfect trailer to discuss Lou. The Doris Day one, the thrill of it all, it's another one where Carl Reiner talks to the camera. I wanted to talk about the cultural significance of Doris Day. And so you try to find themes, you know, and that's what makes it really, really fun for me.
When you talked about gravitational pull, just for a quick second, I was going to say that one of mine is like The Grapes of Wrath, that whenever that film comes on television, it's like, you got jury duty. I hope the jury can wait. I'm sitting down and watching this. I don't care. You know, it's just like, you know, I have to go through and watch that film, right? Doesn't matter where it picks up. I just have to sit down and watch it. You know, and that whole thing with Tom Joad at the end when Fonda's talking to his mother before he leaves, man, I'm just cutting onions. I can't help it. You know, it's just, it just hits me.
When he says, we're the people.
Exactly. Wherever there's a hungry guy, I'll be there. And whenever somebody's getting beat up by a cop, I'll be there. I'm just like, oh man, I can't handle it. Yep.
Yeah. For me, it's Sullivan's Travels. The Godfather 2 is a very common one.
Right.
People
right
hung up. Oh, I just want to see it till Fredo dies, you know. And I just want to see it till he realizes Johnny Ola is the villain, you know, that whatever.
One of my favorites of your trailers is actually one that you said was a shitty trailer, but I loved how you explained it, and that was All That Jazz, because there was no way in that trailer that they could get into the surreal nature of the film. It's just more about the flashiness, the let's put on a show sort of element, which is precisely what the film is not exactly rallying against, but it's not what the film is all about.
I love that movie, and I had just read the biography of Bob Fosse. Mm. And in reading the biography, I realized how the movie was really every beat in his life. Sometimes I'll read a biography of a filmmaker, and right away I'll want to do a trailer from hell about it. That's certainly, or I'll find the stuff that I find fascinating, like how many films the classic directors actually directed. I mean, Michael Curtiz, 200-something films, you know.
Yeah.
Roll Wall. That's why I did Wild Boys for the Road, because William Wellman directed so many movies in the early 30s. And I always liked Wild to the Road. So
that's about it. What do you have anything in closing, Morris?
I wanted to echo what Tim said. We're so immensely grateful that you've taken the time, and we've just really, really enjoyed this conversation about music and films.
Immensely. And you know, I have to say, Alan, that you've given us both a Christmas present here. And I really, really want to thank you for this, you know, giving your time to us. I've always admired everything that you've been involved in right from the get-go. Like I said, you know, being a kid in grade 5 and catching shit for that film and Hollywood Boulevard, I mean, you know, and then coming back and seeing it later again, you know, and loving it. Seeing Rock and Roll High School at the drive-in, and thank you so much. We really, really appreciate
it. Thank you. And I think just keep track of Trailers from Hell. I got a couple more coming up. The Geisha Boy, the Jerry Lewis one, is coming.
Oh, wow.
And if you get Netflix, took a look at the series called the Lemony Snicket one, a series one, Fortunate Events.
I read those books to my son when he was really, really young, and I was only saying to him today, oh, I'm still not up to the Hostile Hospital episodes, which I know were the
one I directed. And I directed a new series for Netflix. They'll be coming out in the spring. It's called Another Life.
I'm going to keep my eyes open for that, definitely.
And, you know, on my Facebook page, the Memories and Music, you know, Music and Memories, Music and Stories.
Yep,
that's also on Trailers
from Hell. Something I wanted to point out to the listeners. If you go to trailersfromhell.com and look under Gurus or just do a search for Alan, then you'll get a link to not just his Trailers from Hell presentations, but also he's doing his biography, as it were, in multiple parts. I've not watched absolutely every episode, but I've watched about 4 or 5 of them.
Okay, well, this is great, guys, talking to people around the world. And have a great holiday.
All the
you
best
too.
To you.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks very much, Alan. Bye. You're listening to episode 59 of See Here Podcast. We'll be back in a moment to tell you what's happening next month. again, our huge thanks to Alan Arkush for taking the time to speak to us here at See Here. Absolutely made our year. So episode 60, which is coming up in January of 2019, we are going to start our sixth year off with another interview. This time we'll be speaking to drummer and director Skiz Cizik. He has released a film in 2018, a documentary called Ice Pick to the Moon. This is a documentary about a man who's been described as the crooner from hell, the Reverend Fred Lane. So this is cabaret music with a difference. Really looking forward to watching that and speaking to Skiz about the film. So that'll be coming up in January of 2019, and hopefully all three of us will be available for that show to speak to Skiz. Housekeeping stuff, if you want to join the Facebook group and start up some film music related discussions, then you can join us at facebook.com/groups/seehear. That's SWHEAR. You can now listen to us on Stitcher and on Spotify, as well as subscribing to iTunes or downloading from the website seehear.podbean.com. All the usual sorts of stuff. I'm sure you know that if you've been listening to us for a while. If you happen to be listening to us for the first time because of our interview with Alan Arkush, thank you. Welcome aboard. We hope that you choose to continue to listen, and those are the ways that you can download us in the future should you choose to do so. So as the year comes to a close, I think I can speak for Tim and Bernie when I say that we've had a wonderful year. We've really enjoyed presenting these shows to you. We do that every year. However, I think this has been a particularly great year. We've had some fun with some unusual choices and some great interviews, and we're going to continue with another couple of months of interviews before getting back to the usual sorts of review type shows that we do. I wish to quickly also thank anyone who was a co-presenter with us this year. So that goes out to Mike White, Professor Michael Benton, and Kerry Fristo. Thanks all of you to joining us for the wonderful discussions that we had. Plus also huge thanks to anyone who granted us an interview for this year to talk about their film work. I'll probably open up the lines sometime in February to get suggestions for requests for films that we should discuss in 2019, bearing in mind that we still have one film from 2018 that was a request from Tyler Kennedy to speak about, so maybe we'll be covering that in March or April. And then we'll get into debt for the next round of requests. Thanks for your patience. Anyway, have a wonderful holiday season. Celebrate Christmas, Kwanzaa, Festivus. Hanukkah is already over at the time as I'm recording this, but happy Hanukkah for next year. So until we speak again in January 2019, have a wonderful time and look after each other. Be nice to each other. We'll speak to you next year. All the best. Cheers.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.